All right. So last time I was up here preaching was 2 months ago, and I finished my series on the chapter of John, chapter 17 in John. That was a recording of Jesus' prayer for his disciples that was recorded, and I had done five of those, and I felt like I had reached the end of what I was going to get from it myself that time, and then I'll come back to it later. So, but I didn't know where I was going to go, and so I've been reading and looking around and listening to other things, and I was struck by this text that we're going to work on today, and so I was compelled by it because of this invitation that I saw from Jesus, and there was another recorded prayer of Jesus. So I felt like, well, there's two things. All right, so another recorded prayer and this invitation that is just wonderful. So let's open our Bibles to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 11. We're actually going to read the whole chapter eventually, but for now, I'm going to start with the end of that, 25 to 30. So Matthew 11, 25 to 30. At that time, Jesus said, "I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for this way was well-pleasing in your sight. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Let's take a second to let Jesus' invitation sink in a little. Come to me. I don't want to let this little phrase just pass by. Where have we seen Jesus use the word come? And what has happened when he did? In John 1, Jesus called two disciples with the phrase, "Come and you will see." And these men had their lives turned upside down. If you will let me expand a little from come to follow, then in Matthew 4, Jesus comes across Simon and Andrew working with their father, and Jesus calls them with, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." The word here is follow, but I'd argue that it is saying the same thing. It's saying, get up, come here to me, and stay with me as I move through the world. And Matthew 4 finishes with, "Immediately they left their nets." I think we often attribute the response of the disciples to the men. We will ask questions like, "Would you drop everything and follow like they did?" But I believe it is more about Jesus speaking the word, "Come and follow." They followed because he invited them, and his words have power to change. Another example of using the word come is in Matthew 14. The disciples are in the boat in a raging storm, and they see a man walking past them on the water. And at one point, Jesus says to Peter, "Come." And Peter gets out of the boat and walks on water toward Jesus. Again, not Peter. It's in the word. It's in the speech of Jesus. That is where the power is. And at the end of John, in chapter 21, we see Jesus restoring Peter by giving him three opportunities to answer that he loves Jesus. These three opportunities were to counter the three times he denied Christ. And when the scene ends, Jesus sums up with, "Follow me." Again, the power that allowed Jesus to come and follow was not in Peter, it was in Jesus' words. Well, here in our text this morning, we see again that Jesus calls people to himself with the words, "Come to me." The power necessary to do that for each of us is not in us. The power needed is in Jesus' words. In fact, Jesus specifically says, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden." He is calling us, he is not calling us to take more effort. He is not calling us to expend more of our power. No, he finishes with, "And I will give you rest." Then we get to the verse that captured my attention. "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart." There's a lot of discussion about our hearts, isn't there? In the church, in the world, about needing to love Jesus with our whole hearts. People talk about needing to have their heart in the game so that they can win. The Old Testament prophets talked about the diseased state of Israel's heart and how God was going to change their hearts from stone into living flesh and write his law directly on their, our hearts. And we read a lot about God's heart and the things that he has a heart for. However, I'm taking from J.C. Ryle here, this is the one verse where we hear about Jesus' heart. And this is not just a place where someone talks about his heart. This is a place where Jesus tells us himself about his heart. This is the whole of what he says specifically about his own heart. He is gentle and humble in heart. I want to make a quick aside here. The King James Version does not use the word gentle in this verse, but rather it uses the word meek. Now, I could just wave my hand and say, they mean the same thing. But I actually did take some time and it dug into this, and I was like, why did they use the word meek rather than gentle? And I think that I came up with the fact that it's actually because the word has changed meaning for us. If we look at the current definition for meek, the current definition is quiet, gentle. Okay, I'm good with that. But then it says, and always ready to do what other people want without expressing your own opinion. What? That is not the Jesus that I know. That is not the meekness that I know. But the meaning, if you look at Samuel Johnson's dictionary from back in 1755, it is mild of temper, not proud, not rough, not easily provoked, soft, gentle. Okay, that definition I see at each point matched up with things that I read about Jesus in the Bible. One more thing is that gentle, the word gentle also has changed since the time that King James was written, and it doesn't mean the same thing it used to mean. In their time, this is again from Samuel Johnson's dictionary, the first definition of gentle was well-born, well-descended, as in a gentleman. A truly British idea, I think. I can see why the King James translators avoided that word, because it has totally against what Jesus was saying in chapter 11. But for us, gentle is a much more common word. And for us, I don't think we use the word meek. And so today I'm going to use gentle, but I really think that it is close enough to meek that I just want us to be able to enter into it rather than be kind of held off by the word meek. Okay, gentle. Gentle. If you got two words to put on your tombstone, is that one of the words you'd put there? For yourself. Jesus chose to describe his heart with two words. Gentle was one of them. The other one was humble. Jesus, the Lord of Lords, King of Kings, one with the Father, described his heart as gentle and humble. For us, gentleness is at best a second-tier virtue. Loyalty, courage, integrity, personal responsibility. Those are the virtues that make America great. Humility, gentleness, compassion, quick to forgive. Yeah, okay, if you force me, I'll call those virtues also. But what about the church? Is gentleness a first-tier virtue in the church? It is in the kingdom of Christ. Is it in the church? Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 3, that an elder of the church, it should be not pugnacious, but gentle and peaceable. Or in a different translation, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome. In 1 Peter 3, verse 4, women in the church are called to be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. A lot of women bristle at that, but isn't Peter just saying to have the heart like Jesus's? A heart of gentleness and humility? That is a high call, and I would say the same to any man in a church. Well, actually, that's exactly what I'm going to do right now. But it is not just leaders and women. In Ephesians 4, 1 and 2, Paul says, "Therefore I, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing tolerance for one another in love." Again, this is almost the same wording as Jesus uses to explain his heart, all humility and gentleness. And finally, go back to the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. I'll repeat from a previous sermon that I did that the fruit of the Spirit is. There is one fruit of the Spirit, and gentleness is a characteristic of it. If I bear the fruit, I will be gentle. So as Christians, first, we are invited to be by a gentle and humble Jesus. He tells us, come to him. And the fact that we can come does not say anything about us, but it speaks to the power of Jesus' words. And second, in verse 29, he specifically says to take up my yoke and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. And we see that this is a call repeated by Jesus and other authors in the New Testament. Being gentle is not optional if I am going to call myself Christian. Now we should do exactly what he tells us to do and learn from him. Let's not assume that the world will teach us what it means to be gentle, but let's look to Jesus to learn. So today I'm going to read the rest of chapter 11. Actually, I'm just going to read it again. And we'll start at verse 1. And we will look to Jesus to define what it means to be gentle. When Jesus had finished giving instructions to his 12 disciples, he departed from there to teach and preach in the cities. Now when John, while imprisoned, heard of the works of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the expected one, or shall we look for someone else?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Go and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, and the lame walk. The lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who does not take offense at me." As these men were going away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about him, about John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? But what did you go out to see? A man dressed in soft clothing? Those who wear soft clothing are in king's palaces. But what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and one who is more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, 'Behold, I send my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare your way before you.' Truly I say to you, among those born of women there has not arisen anyone greater than John the Baptist. Yet the one who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and violent men take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, and if you are willing to accept it, John himself is Elijah who was to come. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. But to what shall I compare this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplaces who call out to the other children and say, 'We played the flute for you, but you didn't dance. We sang a dirge, but you didn't mourn.' For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, 'He has a demon.' The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, 'Behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' Yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds." Then he began to denounce the cities in which most of his miracles were done, because they did not repent. "Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the miracles had occurred in Tyre and Sidon, which occurred in you, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. Nevertheless, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted in heaven, will you? You will descend into Hades. For if the miracles had occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would have remained to this day. Nevertheless, I say to you that it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you." And then what I read before. "At that time, Jesus said, 'I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for this way was well-pleasing to your sight. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Thank God for the word. So there are six parts in this chapter. I've spent my time so far in the last section. Let's take the sections in turn. First, verses 1-6. We have John the Baptizer in prison, hearing that something is going on out there around Jesus. And because he's stuck in prison, he sends his disciples to Jesus to get the news from the source. And when they get to Jesus, he hears the question of John and he answers it truthfully and honestly and gently. I think John here is an example of gentleness. This is often taught as John was unsure and sends his disciples to ask Jesus because he couldn't leave. But I was obviously reading J.C. Ryle, and in his preaching about this, he notes that it doesn't actually say that John had doubts about Jesus, but about Jesus being the Christ. He has been pointing to the Christ, and in the Gospel of John, he says, I must increase so that he must increase so that I must decrease. He will increase and I will decrease. You know the phrase. All right, I'm just getting it wrong. But here, he still has disciples, and we know that his disciples and Jesus' disciples had clashed at some points. And Ryle thinks that John sent his disciples to hear the answer to the question for themselves from Jesus. Now, both of these interpretations could be the case, but for today, in talking about gentleness, I think Ryle's explanation is helpful, because in it, I think we see John being gentle to his disciples. He is not berating them for still following himself, but rather sends them to hear from themselves from Christ. He is providing them with a gentle slope to Christ, if you will. He's inviting them. He's letting Jesus invite them. The second section is verses 7 to 15. After John's disciples have received an answer, Jesus speaks to the crowd about John. He asks them three times, "What did you go out to see?" Or, "Why did you go listen to John?" He tells them they went out there to John because they realized that something was happening that could not be explained in human terms. John was a prophet of the living God. Jesus goes even further. He says, "Truly I say to you, among those born of women, there has not arisen anyone greater than John the Baptist." What? That phrasing causes me to have some questions. He doesn't say that those born from human fathers, because that would be understandable, because that would exclude Jesus. Jesus was born of a woman. I don't understand. But that's what he says. And then in verse 14, Jesus says that John himself is Elijah who was to come. Well, it's easy to agree that if a prophet who didn't die returns, that would be great. There are ways to explain all of this, that Jesus was actually God and not a man, right? I mean, there's lots of ways to do this. But I just want to let Jesus' words stand without me doing too much manipulation. I do want to note one other thing in this section from verse 12. Jesus says, "From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and violent men take it by force." Another way to say that might be, the kingdom of heaven is forcibly entered, and violent men seize it for themselves. That is about as far from gentleness as you can imagine, isn't it? Again, this raises a lot of questions, but here is what I want to take away. If we do not receive the kingdom by the gentle invitation of Jesus, then the only other option is violence. To try to take it, and I mean by try, is that I mean that we try to take something. If we use force, we may force our way on the church in this world, but we will not have the kingdom. How might we try to take the kingdom? Let's look quickly at Matthew 23, verse 4. In this section, Jesus is warning the crowd about the scribes and Pharisees and says, "They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger." I am reminded of something that Pastor Rod said on Tuesday. We are not to judge others. We are to look on our own heart. Based on this text, I would go a little further. I am not to put any additional tradition, any additional requirement, any pet litmus tests, or any burden on anyone else. To do so is to try to violently take the kingdom. If I ask the question like, "Well, but is he really repentant?" I am putting additional burden on that person. That person may eventually satisfy me, and join in my church, but that church is not the kingdom of Jesus. So if we look ahead in Matthew 11 to verse 30, he says, "For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." A yoke distributes the burden between at least two animals, right? Jesus invites us to take his yoke, and his judgment of the scribes and the Pharisees was that they added burden on people but would not join them in carrying it. Jesus is saying they claim to offer salvation through the law, but they won't join in the burden.
Amen.
But Jesus says, "I am the salvation because I do join you in the burden." But don't misunderstand me. The answer is not that we should take the burden or help to take the burden, but the fact is that we will not, but the fact that we won't is proof that we are not the source of salvation. The problem is that we are putting our own barriers on others, and so we are usurping Jesus' role. By adding and judging, we are attempting to take the kingdom by violence, but we won't end up with the right kingdom. Don't add to the burden of those around you. In the next section of our text, verses 16 to 19, Jesus comments on how neither John nor Jesus were good enough for those around them. I'd speak more about this, but I think that Ron covered this really well last week, although he didn't actually mention this text. So we're going to skip the next section. Section 4 is verses 20 to 24. Jesus, who just called John a prophet, speaks a prophetic oracle. He pronounces a doom on the towns where he has been teaching. He says they have not responded, not repented, and so it will be better for clearly evil towns than it will be for them in the day of judgment. A note on those evil cities. I don't think I need to spend much time about Sodom. That one is sufficiently infamous that I think we know the score there. But what about Tyre and Sidon? Are those just random non-Hebrew towns that Jesus picked to use? Well, no, actually. There was a specific reason for naming those two towns. Let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 16, verses 30 to 33. Ahab, son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. It came about as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the errors of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of Sidonians, and went to serve Baal and worshipped him. So he erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria, which was his capital. Ahab also made the Asherah. Thus Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than all the kings of Israel who were before him. And there had been some doozies. So Tyre and Sidon were the cities of the Sidonians, were the city of the Sidonians in the time of King Ahab. And his father Omri made a treaty with the Sidonians, and it was sealed with his son Ahab marrying the daughter of the king of the Sidonians, Jezebel. Recognize that name? She was trouble. This marriage did more to pull the people of Israel from the true worship of God, well, than all the kings that were before them. So these were not just some random cities. These were cities who, through their diplomatic means, had made a very determined attempt to take the kingdom of heaven by violence. And one more link to those cities. Who shows up in 1 Kings 17, verse 1? Elijah, who Jesus just said had come back in the person of John. Remember who Elijah was? He pronounced a doom to Ahab that there would be a drought because of his marriage to Jezebel and all that came as a result of that. And Elijah was the one who stood toe to toe with Jezebel and brought fire from heaven in a standoff with Jezebel's priests, prophets. These are not random cities. He is telling the people who have been listening to John and then to Jesus himself that they have more to answer for than Jezebel's father and the people of Sodom. He is saying that despite having heard the true message of salvation, that they have just stood aloof and they have been distracted by the details and the styles of the messengers, that they have been distracted from the pronouncements they heard. They have not been impressed by either. And despite hearing the good news from both, they continued to try to take the kingdom of heaven by violence, and so they would pay the price. Can we see ourselves in those cities in Galilee? I can see me. I have heard the gentle invitation of Jesus, and I would rather there were obvious theological boundaries. And I say, oh, it isn't enough to accept the invitation. You need to change your whole life around, or I won't accept you into my church. You need to not only accept Jesus' invitation, but you need to buy into my interpretation of this or that doctrine for me to believe that you have changed. And by doing this, I bring violence to the kingdom of heaven. It ceases to be God's church, and it becomes just my church. When people see me getting excited, when they see me getting worked up, am I getting excited about being the gentle invitation of Jesus? Or am I worked up over this or that doctrine that I won't let go of? When people see me getting excited, when they see me getting worked up, am I getting excited about the rest that I have received from Jesus? Or am I worked up over the evil that has overtaken the world and maybe has actually harmed me personally today? I have tried to stick with I and me language here because it is certainly too true of me, but I hope that I won't keep you from honestly looking at yourself also. Well, we have one more section, verse 25 to 27, that we haven't looked at yet. This is the prayer of Jesus. Ever listen to a pastor who will be preaching and then right in the middle of the sermon, he starts praying? Well, that's what Jesus does right here. He finishes his prophetic oracle and goes straight to prayer. I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. And he goes on to say that all things have been handed over to Jesus, and no one will know the Father except Jesus and those that Jesus reveals him to. As in John 17, Jesus claims all knowledge for himself. He claims to be the only gateway to salvation. He is fleshing out what he said in John 10, I am the door. And in John 14, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. We as a church should be inviting all who we meet to meet Jesus. We in the church need to think like John the Baptizer, because our role is to point to Jesus. And when Jesus reveals himself to someone, we the church need to decrease so that he may increase. Is that how we think of the church? How often do we invite people to come to church or to worship instead of inviting them to Jesus? I think we start with the right place. We start with the right idea. We really want people to hear Jesus' invitation, and the church is a place to hear that invitation, the good news. But does the church invite people with the same gentle and humble invitation that Jesus gives? Or does it saddle them with more burden? Why would we heap on burden? I am not saying that we are being cold-hearted, getting pleasure from adding burden to those around us. We know that Jesus provides rest, and we want people around us to see that rest, But sometimes it just seems like they don't feel burdened. Sometimes they don't act weary. So we want to make it so that they feel the burden and might add burden to that end so that they will recognize how they are needy they are, how needy they are. But that's not gentleness. That is usurping Jesus' role. He is the one who wills to reveal the Father. Jesus invites each of us every day to come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. What fantastically gracious words of invitation. Each day when I look and just see weariness and feel heavy laden, Jesus is there to call me to himself anew. Can you imagine the gentleness and the humbleness that must require of Jesus to do that every day for each of us? So what have we learned about being gentle in this chapter? Gentleness holds out an invitation, a true invitation to Jesus. Gentleness is wanting those around us who are overburdened and weary to receive the rest Jesus offers. That is, gentleness loves those who are gentleness loves those around us who we see burdened and weary. Gentleness is not adding to the burden of those already carrying a heavy burden, or even those who do not feel burdened. Gentleness is wanting the rest we have received from Jesus for everyone we meet, whether they are friend, family, rich, poor, beggar, immigrant, churchgoer, or enemy of the church. Gentleness is not judging anyone but myself, because when I judge that someone is being worthy, then I stop telling them about the rest Jesus offers to them. Heavenly Father, this is a very hard word for me. I do not see myself or want to see myself many times as gentle. And yet you call me to be just that to everyone that I meet. You call me to only hold out you, the rest that you provide. Lord, help me to do just that. Help me to hold out your rest to those around me who I know are struggling, who I know are heavy burdened. Allow me to play the part that you have given me to play. And allow us as a church to point only to you. To point only to you and not to worry about ourselves, but only worry about you and your kingdom. I pray this in Jesus' strong name. Amen.